to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Have you ever wondered why Canada is in debt? Have you ever wondered why the government forces Canadians to pay so many taxes? Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why the gross national debt is over $800 billion? Or why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion? What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada.
That is 12-year-old Victoria Grant of Canada delivering the opening statements of her virally spread beating to the most powerful financial and political forces in her country and the Western world, calling it like it is to the public banking conference in Philadelphia back in 2012. Today on It's Our Money, Ellen speaks with one of the principal parties in Canada associated with the dramatic courtroom development that has the prospect of upending bankster control of the sovereign right of Canadians to have their money issued debt-free from their own Bank of Canada. Later on the program, we'll hear more of Victoria's speech and analyze how true and timely her comments continue to be. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Well, President Obama is pushing hard this month for fast-track authority on two trade agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. One of them is with Asian countries, and the other is with European countries. Fast track basically means bypassing any real input and oversight by Congress. But a number of activist groups are pushing hard back, including our favorite Washington activists, Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, who showed their commitment on January 27th by managing to spend 4 hours in jail as a result of protest. Kevin and Margaret have been our guests a couple of times. Kevin gave an update on December 31st on the issues, so if you're interested, you can check our archives. But what I want to talk about today, more specifically, is the effect of these trade agreements, or the effect that these trade agreements could have on publicly owned institutions, and more specifically, publicly owned banks. Supposedly, the trade agreements are about trade. Supposedly, promoting trade, opening borders to trade. But we already saw, this is supposed to help employment, U.S. employment, but we already saw that they don't really have that effect. We saw that with NAFTA, where there was a worse effect from the cheap imports that NAFTA allowed than we got from the extra exports that we were able to send out of the country. But anyway, the majority of the chapters in the TPP aren't even about trade. The actual details of these agreements are being kept pretty secret, but we do know the general gist of the chapters, and only 5 of 29 chapters are about trade. The other 24 are basically about getting government off the backs of the big corporations, various ways that they can get around government regulations and protect their profits from competition. And the most outrageous element of these deals is that these big corporations will be allowed to sue governments for doing things that hurt corporate profits. So governments can't even protect the interests of their own people. They have to allow these corporations to sell products to their people, even if they might be toxic or in other ways actually damage the people or the environment or the culture, etc. And the trade deals particularly target government-owned institutions. For example, interesting fact, Nebraska is the only state in the country where all the Nebraska residents get their electricity from a government-owned institution. So for that reason, Nebraska residents pay unusually low, their electricity bills are unusually low, and this is because the government-owned institution is a nonprofit, which is able to return its profits to the institution and to the economy. And so they are able to undercut the prices of the big multinational competitors. But under these trade agreements, the competitors might be able to sue Nebraska for undercutting their prices, for having what's called an unfair trade advantage. But really, their trade advantage is simply that they're not siphoning profits off somewhere else, but are returning the profits to the people. And the same threat could be facing publicly owned banks from these trade agreements. In the U.S., of course, we only have one state-owned depository bank, the Bank of North Dakota, but we're hoping to get some more set up and also some local publicly owned banks. The Bank of North Dakota was recently shown in a Wall Street Journal article, which I wrote another article about, to outperform big Wall Street banks such as J.P. Morgan Chase. And the way they're able to outperform is that they have lower costs. Basically, they have the guarantee of the government. They don't have to advertise. They're actually a wholesale bank that partners with the local bank, which the local bank goes out and finds the actual customer. So they don't deal directly with the customers, or they don't speculate in derivatives. They do very conservative lending. So they know their market and they don't make bad loans, and they come out being highly profitable. So in theory, the big Wall Street banks might be able to turn around and sue the Bank of North Dakota for having a business model that the Wall Street banks simply can't compete with. And a large part of that is the fact that the bank is government-owned and therefore has the backing of the government. But it has the backing of the government because it is the government. So basically, you'd be suing the government for operating in an efficient manner that serves the best interests of its people. The Wall Street Journal article attributed the Bank of North Dakota's stellar results to the oil boom, but I showed in my article about their article that couldn't actually explain the results. But we now have confirmation from Germany with a January 2015 study put out by the Sparkassen Group in Germany. The Sparkassen are municipally owned banks which service the small and medium-sized businesses in Germany, and they actually dominate that particular market in Germany. So there are lots and lots of these banks, and the study drew its figures from the Bundesbank, the German central bank, and these figures showed that the Sparkassen were dramatically more profitable than the private commercial banks. And they paid a lot more in taxes. They were more profitable before taxes were deducted and after taxes were deducted. So they were triply profitable for the local economy. First of all, they're profitable in themselves and the government owns them. Second of all, they pay a lot more in taxes. And third of all, they provide a stable source of funding for the small and medium-sized businesses. And that's why the German economy is so strong. And it's something that we really desperately need in the U.S. And we could get that by setting up our own publicly owned banks. But these public banks would run the risk of being sued under TPP for having the natural advantages that a publicly owned bank has. So for that reason, and many other reasons, we really seriously need to stop the TPP and the TTIP, and particularly we need to stop their fast-tracking. So if you want to know what you can do to help, you can go to stopfasttrack.com or fleshthetpp.org. And I might just add, if we really wanted to stop unfair competition, we would get rid of the big multinational corporations because they clearly have an unfair competitive advantage as against the small farmers and the small and medium-sized businesses. So in other news in the public banking arena, the Comer Group in Canada just won an appeal on its lawsuit against the Bank of Canada. Comer stands for the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. In December 2011, Comer, along with two individuals, sued the Bank of Canada in federal court to try to force the bank to return to its mandated purposes. They want the Bank of Canada to provide interest-free loans to the federal and local governments, as provided for in the Bank of Canada Act, which was passed in 1939. The federal government did borrow interest-free from the Bank of Canada until 1974, but today it borrows from private banks at market rates of interest, which have unnecessarily driven up the federal debt exponentially. So the latest news on that front is that the government attempted to have the case thrown out for failure to state a claim, and it lost on that ground. And it appealed, and on January 26th of this year, the appeal was rejected in federal court in Toronto. So we'll be hearing more about that lawsuit and about what Canada achieved in its first 35 years when it was borrowing interest-free from its own bank from our next guest. My guest today is Dr. Jerry Ackerman, a financial analyst who is heavily involved in the public banking and monetary reform movements in Canada and manages a website at occupyourbank.ca that is loaded with information on those subjects. He has attended all the hearings on the Comer lawsuit against the Bank of Canada and is ready to fill us in on the details. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, all. Good to be here.
So it's great we managed to get connected. We had a little problem with that going up to Canada. So the Bank of Canada has been sued by Comer, which stands for the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, along with two individual plaintiffs, Ann Emmett and Bill Krim. I've met Bill. He's an amazing centenarian. He just celebrated his 101st birthday, which is an amazing achievement in itself. My mother is actually 95, and she's still struggling with crossword puzzles. So how Bill has managed to achieve all that he's done in his senior years, including bringing a viable lawsuit against the Bank of Canada, is absolutely remarkable. And this isn't your ordinary lawsuit. It has the potential to be paradigm-changing. So, Jerry, can you fill us in on what the suit is about and what the current status is?
Yes, it is a paradigm, as you said, a paradigm shift. And if we're successful at this and the government responds appropriately, then Canada has a future, a positive future. And without that, I think we're going the way of Greece and Iceland and Ireland and all the other downtrodden, debt-ridden countries. So the present status, the lawsuit was initiated in 2011. And the response from the government is always to deny and then delay. So it was delayed for most of a year, in December 2012. Then the motion to strike, which means dismiss the...
Could you tell us what the lawsuit's about and what the issues are?
Oh, it was to reinstate the use of the Bank of Canada, which has never gone away. It was there initiated in the late 1930s, and it is our bank. Canada owns it. All the shares are held in trust by the Minister of Finance. He is a fiduciary for all of us. And when he is instructed to approach the governor of the Bank of Canada and create money, then for whatever project the government decides, they spend that money into the economy, and we go forward. That's what happened in the 1940s. We created the full employment coming out of the Depression, and that's how the money got created to fight the war and build the necessary munitions, the airplanes, and train the soldiers and all that kind of thing. And we did that successfully, and we rewarded at the end of the war. The surviving veterans came back, and we educated them. We educated them in a big way. They got university education in lots of cases, and we helped them start a business, and in case I know nearby, bought a farm. So that was to start, but then what we did was we created more money to build the infrastructure of the whole country, the St. Lawrence Seaway, and part of that the Welland Canal, and that was deepened and widened, so that the next thing we did was the Trans-Canada Highway. We didn't have a highway between, say, Toronto and Winnipeg then, but this one went all the way across the country, 4,000 miles.
Wow.
Then we decided that we needed, the government decided, and we didn't argue with them, that we needed universal health care for everybody. That was another act passed, and that money was again created by the our own bank, and without interest, and spent into the building hospitals and all the necessary things. We also wanted to provide pensions for the old folks, and in my case, my father was quite elderly, but he managed to have a few years of $40 a month coming, which was the first time any money had come into the community from outside the community that I grew up in. The addition to that were their family allowances, and I remember in the early 60s, my own kids qualified for, up to age 16 for a family allowance. It wasn't very much, but it was there, and every month, I think it was $5 or $6 per kid, and that was a help. So that's the kind of thing that was done then, and it was interest-free, and it didn't create a debt, and the banks were restricted. The private banks were restricted in their lending, and this is the part that has not been well publicized. A bank at that time, in let's say the 60s, when I was going into business in some ways and advising farmers and so on, a bank could only lend money for 4 years. And it could only charge 6% interest. And those that meant that, yes, they created money, but they created a limited amount for a limited time, and they didn't overcharge for the interest. Now, those regulations were removed by 1974, and then the bankers, the private bankers, really took over the money supply creation of with the admonitions from the Bank of International Settlements over in Basel, Switzerland, who said, don't you be borrowing from your own banking system and paying interest. I'm sorry, don't be borrowing from your own bank and not paying interest. You've got to support the bankers. And so that's what was done ever since, from 74 to the present. The national, every time there was a deficit, of course there were all kinds of deficits with the interest charges, the deficit was added to the national debt that began in 1974 as $18 billion, quite manageable for a 30 million population, and we were a prosperous country at that stage. And then the runaway inflation that we had in the late 70s was created really by the bankers, who were creating money hand over fist and weren't restricted. The previous governor of the Bank of Canada back through the 40s and 50s and 60s would have restricted the not just the interest rate, I would have raised the interest rate, but that isn't so important. The interest rate that the governor controls is just the overnight interest to balance the books of the various bankers. And that really, that's just a symbolic gesture.
Can I go back a little bit to the 1970s? So my understanding is that at that time we had stagflation, which meant that the prices were inflating, but the economy was stagnant. And so the Bank for International Settlements and economists generally, globally, Milton Friedman, the whole Milton Friedman School, said that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. In other words, that it's caused by governments printing money
or by governments borrowing from their own central banks interest-free, as Canada was doing, and not necessarily paying the loan back, or, you know, just rolling over the loan, which would increase the money supply, which would drive prices up. But in fact, as I understand it, during those, was it, let's see, late 30s to 70s was 35 years or so, that the country was borrowing from its own central bank, you didn't have price inflation. Prices only started going up like in the late 60s, and that was for other reasons. For example, the price of oil quadrupled in 1974 when we had that 9 days war, and apparently Henry Kissinger collaborated with the OPEC nations to fix the prices quite a bit higher. And so that was one thing, that every country had to have more reserves than they already had in dollars in order to buy oil. I mean, the deal was Henry Kissinger negotiated with the OPEC countries that they would buy oil only in dollars. And Henry Kissinger said, I am going to make you very rich. I'm going to quadruple the price of oil. But in return, you will sell your oil only in dollars and you will put your dollars in our Wall Street and Bank of England banks. And so they agreed to that. So that forced all the countries to borrow dollars because they weren't anticipating needing that kind of reserves. Then there was the problem that unions were very strong then, so they were pushing for higher wages. And then the very fact of interest rates going up imposed extra costs on the businesses, so they had to charge more for their products. So if you put all that together, it was actually cost-push inflation, and not an inflation resulting from an increase in the money supply, as you could see in Canada, because the money supply did increase, but the prices didn't go up. Would I be correct in that?
Yes, certainly in Canada, as elsewhere, the price of oil not only tripled, it was six times by the end, between 72 and 79. It was from $12 to six times that. So.
Wow.
The point that's often missed is what the villains, I call the bankers that are not doing the right thing as they should be doing on behalf of the public interest, I call them banksters. And what they were doing during the 70, from 74 on, was that they were lending many times what they had in reserve, and they were adding to the reserves by issuing more shares, and selling them. And once relieved from the pressure of four-year terms to no limit, then they took over the trust industry's business. The trust industry that would lend you money for a mortgage was issuing a GIC, or a CD, you call them, let's say a five-year maximum, or three, or one. And they were paying the rate of interest on that and adding a percent or so that they had a profit, and thus what the mortgage would be. And the terms of the mortgage would be a five-year renewable interest mortgage, like a 20 or 30-year mortgage, but the interest rate could change every 5 years because they only got the money from the investors and they had to pay the going rate for that, and then add their profit and administrative costs to that. So when the banks moved in on them, they could create money, you see, themselves, and out of nothing, of course. And they took on the mortgage industry away, and they took it away from the trust industries, because by 1980, well, my brother bought a CD, I think it was a three-year CD, and he got paid 17% on it. So if you were a trust company trying to pass on that to a resident, it was a prudently managed industry. So it was impossible for the trust industry to survive the onslaught of the banksters. So the trust industry collapsed and the bankers bought the remnants. And in the case of our most classic example, the Royal Bank, the biggest bank, bought the biggest trust industry and got it for nothing. And they even got the welfare management part free. It was named Royal Trust as well. So that's the kind of thing that happened at the end of the 70s, early 80s in Canada. So we,
and that's when interest rates went up to 20% or something.
We destroyed the trust industry by moving it into the banking industry.
And in the U.S., that's when they started selling off mortgages to investors, and so then you wound up with the whole subprime scam, which collapsed.
We did that starting in 2006 when we had a new government, and they brought in AIG and Wells Fargo and General Electric, along with the villains in Canada, and they increased the mortgage insurance from $75 billion to $200 billion. And that's where our bailout happened, because these banksters moved in and they did some 30- and 40-year mortgages with nothing down, and just as they'd done in the United States. And then that took $125 billion out of the insurance fund. So the mortgages then were rescued by the Bank of Canada in this case, and then dumped onto our CMHC, which is our crown agency that always did the mortgages and always did it in a prudent way. And then suddenly they've got these toxic mortgages on their books, and they're still there. But the villains, the banksters, they went tax-free and scot-free, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. And they're still... the media simply said that we didn't get bailed out, but that was only one of the bailouts in Canada. The other one was the asset-backed commercial paper, which stopped everybody's working capital for 7 months. That was a really dirty one that was awfully hard on some of the major businesses.
I'm not familiar with that, so how did that work?
A little differently than in the U.S., but the consequences were severe for not just major businesses like Transat was one. They have Transair airline, and CAS. The CAS in Quebec is a major financial institution that looks after the pensions of Quebec and so on. And they were hit with $13 billion out of the $31 billion that was stalled. You couldn't access your working capital. Let's say you were, in one case that I know well, a mine, and you had the money raised to develop the mine, and so you simply put it into commercial paper as working capital. And it was.
Sorry, could you define commercial paper for our listeners?
Paper is just something that's created, that's issued by an intermediary, not a bank as such, but it's banks can do it, but also other shadow bankers can do it too. And the shadow bankers were like General Electric is a shadow banker and so on.
So commercial paper is like a promissory note where somebody
gives
you money?
And it's usually short term, and just means that your working capital then can earn a little bit more than just sitting in a bank at a savings account or something.
So then how did that block the businesses from reaching?
Well, because the financial intermediaries, the shadow bankers, as I'm calling them, and the banksters of the regular private banks, they paid a higher rate of interest. Instead of 1%, say, they would pay 1.75% or something like that. And they said that this is asset debt. And the assets were toxic assets. They were like... Well, in the U.S., they were subprime loans, that was primarily.
Subprime loans to businesses as opposed to to homeowners. Right.
And in addition to that, you had the international global banksters, not just from the U.S., but from Europe and elsewhere. They were in there with betting against the old credit default swap story. So... the net result was that the money was not there to as the working capital, and 7 months went by from August to January that people could not access, the businesses could not, and the cash as well, could not access their money. And then subsequent to that, it took, well, they either took a hit on it and sold it to somebody else who'd wait, but otherwise they got a delay on when they would be able to use it over quite some time. Anyway, that was our second bailout.
going back to the Bank of Canada then. So
what should have happened during all this time, of course, was that the necessary money for the government goods and services that we needed should have been funded by the Bank of Canada, and the Minister of Finance should have ordered it, and that money should have been spent into the economy as it had been in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. That's what should have happened. What we should have done that we didn't do were things like build hospitals. Some of those are private hospitals or privatized public partnerships and so on. We should have built the bridge to Prince Edward Island. That was done privately. We should have done the major electricity supply coming from Labrador to Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, instead of just having a government guarantee to the privateers who are going to be charging and paying interest.
And I understand these are what's called self-funding loans, too, like what Roosevelt did, or they could have been, like what Roosevelt did in the 30s, where we're not talking about just pumping money into the economy that just goes out there and doesn't come back, but they're actually loans because the central bank is owned by the government. Then yep. the bank gets the interest back, and it gets paid back from the proceeds of the whatever it was that you're building. Like, say, if it's a seaway, roadway, et cetera, you can charge fees for those things, or electricity. And that's what Roosevelt did. And, in fact, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was the government-owned vehicle that Roosevelt used because he couldn't get the Federal Reserve to do it, actually turned a profit after something like 30 years. I mean, they rebuilt the entire country. They financed the U.S. participation in World War II, and they still turned a profit at the end of all that.
Yes, well, there was one major difference in from 39-40-41, Canada versus the U.S., was that we were at war in September 1939, to help the mother country, and we fully employed everybody. We provided, we were the fourth largest munitions supplier to the war, and we were just a little country. So that's what we did, and it was 2 years later before the U.S. even declared war. But that's not well known, of course, in the U.S.
Yeah.
They think they started the war and won the war.
So that lays the groundwork then for what this whole lawsuit's about. So then, do you want us to say what the actual pleadings are? In other words, what relief is being sought and the status of the suit?
Well, what I wanted to say first is that the major issue from 1974 till present is that we have paid unnecessary interest on our national debt. Our national debt's only something like 35 or 40 billion, but the compound interest since has put it up to 600 and 700 billion.
Wow.
That's unnecessary interest, and it amounts to presently, if you count in the federal debt and the provincial debt and the municipal debt, put those together, and you've got like 65 or 70 billion dollars per year.
Did you say million or billion?
Say that. We should have used that $1 trillion for building the hospitals that were done privately, and for building the bridge, as I said, and highways, and various things that have been privatized that should not have been. And the present urge in Canada is to privatize your post office. You probably know about that in the U.S. It's similar there. That's another issue, it's a vital one. I want to tell you that our CEO comes from Pitney Bowes in the United States, and that's the intent, is to ruin our post office so it can be bought on the cheap and won't go into postal banking, because the postal banking study, it was an 800-page study, a report on it, that the Canada Post did and reported, but there was a small reduction here of over 700 pages. So what the report itself actually said was that European countries that did their own banking in the post office were very, very profitable, and that Canada would be too. And so uh, the government saw that that was not public information. In the same way as they've seen that there's no media attention to this litigation against the government and against the Minister of Finance.
Well, in a shameless plug of my book, I will say that I've written chapters on all of that in my latest book, The Public Bank Solution, available on my website at ellenbrown.com. And I'll just give you this opportunity to give your website as well and anything else you want to plug. I mean, we're not done talking, but I just thought I would put that in there in case people are a little confused by all this. Go ahead.
Well, I say one thing more known about the litigation itself. It's gone through its third hearing, and I've been present each, and Bill Krim and Emmett have been front and center, and Paul Hellyer is along with them at the last one. This lawyer, Rocco Collodi, is the best known and probably the most effective constitutional lawyer that Canada has. So that's how important it is. This is a constitutional issue because the Constitution says that the government runs the money system and not the private banks. And so that's the essence of it, of the litigation. And it will go forward, but it will take some time.
As I understand, so there was a recent hearing, an appellate court hearing, in which originally the Bank of Canada had managed to get this case dismissed as not stating a claim. Is that correct? But that was overturned. So now the declaratory relief action can proceed. I understand that the action for damages still isn't proceeding, but the declaratory relief action is. And if that could actually get publicized, if people knew about it and people understood what the bank used to do and what it should still be doing, I mean, that definitely could be a groundbreaker.
Yes, about the tort aspect, the damages, you see, it's true that the initial claim did not emphasize how the plaintiffs were damaged, you see, but that certainly belongs later along the line when the judge at that time is asking for what damages occurred and on all these Canadians. And that's where the $1 trillion figure is and all the lost opportunities for human capital improvement during that time. What kind of a country we'd have if we'd used that money productively on our own interests instead of paid it off to the banking, both foreign and local bankers. That's the real issue that's still there, and that's why some of us are collecting people that understand this and their postal codes so that our constitutional lawyer, when challenged in court on what do you mean about these two old people and these old plaintiffs, maybe they'll be dead by then, how were they damaged, and why there should be any breach of the contract. And that's where I want there to be a long list of people with the postal codes, Canadian postal codes, and for our lawyer to present them in court. That's why I'm encouraging people to contribute to the litigation expenses, which will be large, of course.
How can people sign up, or how will they... Can you give some information on how they can help, what they can do, who they can reach, what the website is?
OccupyOurBank.ca website has some information there about what you're to do. The piece that I presented there, saying I'm mad as hell, explains much of this, but it also gives the address and name of a Comer treasurer, and so there, a check that's made out to Comer, C-O-M-E-R, nothing more than that, can be sent to that person. Now, I emphasize, add the postal code for whoever is sending it. So that's where the litigation is, and that's an optimistic view of the future, and I hope that Bill Krim lives to see it.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. I mean, it would be wonderful if you had a win on that. But it even without that, I mean, just publicizing all those issues is great and an important service. And your website is great. I have a couple other questions that are unrelated, but one was that I know you've had some involvement with Native Indian groups in Canada that have attempted to set up their own bank. Do you have anything to report on that? How's it going?
Well, the idea is a long-term development, and it calls for very careful maneuvering. Certainly, there'll be no major publicity about it, but the essence of what we have developed in our own minds between us is that it needs to be a trustworthy community currency, and the longer-term use of the money will be a credit. It has to be a credit against what? Well, against what? That's the answer, and it's not a piece of paper. It is a stock of silver. That is, silver you can trust, because silver is useful. Silver has a market value.
So you would have a bank issuing a local currency, in other words, the currency of the, are they tribes? Do we call them tribes?
Yes. This is for what we call Turtle Island Trust, put it that way.
Turtle Island Trust would be issuing Turtle Island certificates of some sort that were backed by silver, is that right?
The community currency would be in the form of a small piece of silver that was marked totally pure.
Uh-huh.
And there would be a stock of silver cached away in a mountain, and that would be the, good faith and trust, whatever you call that.
Uh-huh.
That the credit contractor, you know, who built the bridge or the school or the hospital on the reservations, or that the human capital part, the health and education, are so crucial to First Nations, and, well, the rest of us too, but they're much more severely limited over the last 150 to 200 years for indigenous tribes. Mm-hmm. So that's what the plan is, and it's very much under development.
Okay. And one other thing, since you're a financial advisor, people always ask me, what shall I do with my money? Because they're worried about bail-ins, that the big banks are liable to take their money in a bail-in, which is now basically official, that a big bail bank that becomes insolvent can confiscate your money and turn it into equity. But then if put it into, I mean, everything seems to be a bit vulnerable. The stock market is vulnerable, et cetera. So what do you recommend? Should they diversify, or does that make it too difficult to keep track of their money? Without getting too specific, but I just meant some general advice from your years of experience.
No, I've never been a diversifier, and I think a mutual fund is a mistake. That's a strong enough statement, maybe, on that, that aspect. But when I watch, as you do, what happens to the money that is provided by the taxpayer to the banking system, and they bid up the price of stocks in New York, and they gamble on the derivatives, which have priority. You've explained all this very well when you talk about bail-ins, that we won't do bailouts anymore, we just do bail-ins, and we villains will wipe out the depositors, municipal, state, and individuals. And that's the real risk. So get your money out of a bank, your deposit money, and get it. And that, I'm speaking to municipalities and states as well as individuals. And I'm saying credit unions, now you have to study your own credit union and see if it does invest in derivatives. Most don't, but maybe yours does, but make sure that it doesn't. And make sure it's well managed, because you can study the management of your own credit union, a nearby one. And cash is not trash yet. It might be, but it isn't yet. But there's no point in having it in a savings account, getting 0.5% a year. That when inflation is a lot more. So what I do some counseling of individuals, but my long-term message has been stop borrowing money and stop spending money and stop trusting somebody else with your money. Now, if you follow those three red lights and stop short three times, Then you have to say, well, where do I go? And then I say, well, two things. You go, you build community. Start building community where you are, and learn to grow food, those things. And so when I listen to people say, well, I'm pretty old to learn to, and I live in a condo, don't have a garden, what can I do? I say, well, I have a couple of companies that I've studied for 30 years, and one of them is in the food business, and one of them is in the fuel business. And those are two things that people want after a financial collapse, food and fuel. So that's the kind of thing I do, but I certainly don't diversify. I wouldn't, if I were going into business, and I've gone into business, I don't go into three businesses or 30 businesses or 300 businesses all at once, for heaven's sake. That's what you do if you buy a mutual fund. But one more thing I'd say is that beware of the banksters. They've taken over almost all the stock exchange trading to their own interest and not to the investor interest. So don't be trying to be successful with a don't sleep with a snake, put it that way, with a python anyway, with the private equity traders and with the hedge funds. They're there to prey upon you. So make your own decisions, but do some very careful research work first.
Okay. Well, that's great. I guess we've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much for giving us those insights on what's going on in Canada and what we can do with our money. My guest today has been Dr. Jerry Ackerman, a financial analyst in Canada, whose website is occupyourbank.ca, which is where you can go if you want to help with the lawsuit of the Comer Group against the Bank of Canada.
Canadian Victoria Grant was 12 years old when she delivered a speech at the Philadelphia Conference of the Public Banking Institute back in 2012 that has now been heard by over 3 million people, thanks to the Internet. Her school's speech project was initially delivered to about 600 businessmen in Canada and later received standing ovations from conference goers in Philadelphia and elsewhere. The truth that seemed obvious to Victoria, that private bank interests were unnecessarily ripping off the people of Canada, arrived as rather shocking news to most of the people living there, who just assumed that the debt that they were paying off was an absolute necessity. As discussed previously, it's an institutionalized deception foisted upon the people by international banking interests who continue to want to consolidate their global financial control through a handful of private banks. The same could be said for the United States, whose sovereign right to issue its own money, debt-free, was absconded by a small group of bank politicos at Jekyll Island back in 1913 when they engineered the Federal Reserve. Just as before the American Revolution, the citizens of America were thrown back into debt peonage by international bankers. And here we sit today, still unnecessarily paying our hard-earned money to a financial oligarchy that we freed ourselves from 250 years ago. So let's listen once again to pieces of Victoria's argument about what happened in Canada during the 20th century. That's a lesson for us here in the United States and reflects upon the importance of this Canadian lawsuit that Ellen was talking about. Canada never had financial problems. It had a robust economy until 1974, when the international bankers made them change their ways. Canada built some of its greatest assets, like the Trans-Canada Highway and the St. Lawrence Seaway, without throwing the country into unmanageable debt. So Victoria raises some simple questions.
Have you ever wondered why Canada is in debt? Have you ever wondered why the government forces Canadians to pay so many taxes? Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why the gross national debt is over $800 billion? Or why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion?
Her conclusion is at the heart of the lawsuit that Eleanor was just discussing with Jerry Ackerman.
What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada. I will share with you three important points of reference, which will hopefully spark enough interest and concern for you to continue the research on your own and to engage your government to stop this criminal act against the people of Canada.
This historic lawsuit, which no media in Canada has been allowed to report upon, alleges some very serious charges, as reported here by Global Research News. The plaintiffs state that since 1974, there's been a gradual but sure slide into the reality that the Bank of Canada and Canada's monetary and financial policy are dictated by private foreign banks and financial interests that are contrary to the Bank of Canada Act. Listen to how clearly Victoria describes the mechanics of this institutionalized banking scam.
Until the 1970s, because of the Bank of Canada, Canada's national debt was held at a constant manageable level, until the government decided to implement what we now have as our modern-day banking system that is robbing the Canadian people. So how are they robbing us? Allow me to explain how our private banks and government work today. First, the Canadian government borrows money from the private banks. They then lend the debt-based money to Canada with compounded interest. The government then continues to increase taxation of Canadians year after year in order to pay back the interest on the exponentially growing national debt. What results is inflation, thus real money for Canadians to spend into our economy, and the real money being used to pad the pockets of the banks. Also, the government gave the banks the ability to loan out money that doesn't exist in the form of loans.
So here's how Global Research describes the explosive potency of this lawsuit. They say, the plaintiffs state that the Bank of International Settlements, the Financial Stability Forum, and the International Monetary Fund, we know it as the IMF, were all created with the cognizant intent of keeping poorer nations in their place, which has now expanded to all nations in that these financial institutions largely succeed in overriding governments and constitutional orders in countries such as Canada, over which they exert financial control, end quote. And the plaintiffs state that since the meetings of the BIS and the Financial Stability Board are secret, their discussions and deliberations are not available nor accountable to Parliament or the executive nor the Canadian public, Bank of Canada policies directly emanate from these meetings, thereby giving these essentially private foreign entities controlling power over Canada's banking system and socioeconomic policies. And here's the kicker. The plaintiffs state that the defendants, the officials involved, were unwittingly and or wittingly, in varying degrees, knowledgeable and intent on engaging in a conspiracy, along with the BIS, FSB, IMF, to render impotent the Bank of Canada Act, as well as Canadian sovereignty over financial, monetary, and socioeconomic policy, and to bypass the sovereign rule of Canada through its parliament by means of banking and financial systems. Now, Victoria adds a little cultural context to that situation.
What I find interesting is even Jesus in Matthew 21 drove out the money changers in the temple because they were manipulating the currency to steal money from the people. The private banks are just like the money changers in Matthew 21. They are defrauding and robbing the people of Canada, thus their freedom, and they need to be stopped.
So how can this international financial cartel be stopped? Victoria provides a history lesson from Canadian parliamentary history that could be repeated in the U.S. and elsewhere.
How should the banking system work? In an infamous interview, Mr. McGeer asked Mr. Towers, can you tell me why a government with power to create money should give that power away to a private monopoly and then borrow that which Parliament can create itself back at interest to the point of national bankruptcy? Mr. Towers replied, if Parliament wants to change the form of operating the banking system, then certainly that is within the powers of Parliament.
In other words, if Canada or the U.S. wanted to get out from under the grip of global private bankers, they could. That's why it's called a sovereign right. Then Victoria does a beautiful rendition of Ellen Brown's public bank logic. If you own the bank, you don't need to pay interest to yourself to borrow it.
In other words, if the Canadian government needs money, they can borrow it directly from the Bank of Canada. The people would then pay fair taxes to repay the Bank of Canada. This tax money would in turn get injected back into our economic infrastructure and the debt would be wiped out. Canadians would again prosper with real money as the foundation of our economic structure and not debt money. And yes, we have the power and lawful right to do so.
You can see that the current lawsuit in Canada is extremely important to preserving the survival of the powers that control our economies and our governments. Keep an eye on it if you can find any Canadian media willing to report on it. So there you have it, from an unjaundiced observer who doesn't accept the common delusion that the web of debt that we take for granted and knows that it's actually orchestrated by the private global banking cartel, which is really like the emperor who wears no clothes. Let's hear Victoria Grant's conclusion.
In conclusion, it has become painfully obvious, even for me, a 12-year-old Canadian, that we are being defrauded and robbed by the banking system and a complicit government. What will we do to stop this crime? What will we do to ensure that the next generation will live free and clear of the debt-based economy that enslaves them to the banks? Margaret Mead said the following, and I hope that all of you remember this. Never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Thank you.
That wraps up another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Be sure to follow Ellen's writings and blog conversations at ellenbrown.com. And for information about public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Our sincere thanks to Payment Management for their support of this program and for their commitment to economic justice, fairness, and the expansion of public banks around the U.S. If you require credit card processing services, you're invited to receive a free review of your processing expenses by Payment Management at paymentmgmt.com. Thanks to our guests and to you for listening. On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Join us next time as Ellen talks with Paul Craig Roberts. See you then on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money!